In March 2019, Cyclone Idai hit central Mozambique. Thousands of lives were lost, but the subsequent flooding from the Buzi River proved to be the real killer, displacing whole villages and livelihoods. The Sunday Times covered the story when it first occurred, but in an increasingly rare-play in journalism these days, we went back a year later to check in on the very people we did the story with initially. You can view the full feature on the Times Live news site under the headline Tales of Agadja, a Year After Cyclone Idai, and we've put the link in the description. But myself, Scott Peter Smith, caught up with Emil and Alistair after they got back, snuck back into South Africa just before the Stage 5 lockdown, to hear a little more about their journey. Audio is a little bit shaky, but I think we're all getting used to it with the numerous Zoom meetings. Have a listen and check out the feature. Thanks for joining, guys. We're joined by Emil Bosch, a multimedia journalist at the with Times Live, Multimedia Live Department, and Alistair Russell, Sunday Times photojournalist. They recently went to Mozambique to take a year retrospective, a year later from the Cyclone Idai. Emil and Alistair, I don't know if you can just maybe for the listeners give a little bit of a context to the story and why you felt this was a story to cover.
I think it was we knew we had to do it because we had firsthand accounts of things that had happened last year and the days that preceded the flooding in the wake of Cyclone Idai. It was the flooding that had the biggest effect on human life there. And we traveled there last year and got access to a community that was directly affected and completely washed away. And we were able to tell their stories a few days after these things had happened. I remember it having a sort of a profound effect, you know, on being there and seeing this community and stuff like that. And in the months that led up to the anniversary, I mean, we were talking about it throughout the year, going back and sort of telling the story 1 year later. So it was a long time in planning. It was months. We were conceptualizing this project for a very long time and thinking about it in the months that are leading up. But so I mean, the whole driving force behind it, I guess, the inception and the seed of where it is today started a few days after the floodwaters actually receded in Mozambique.
Maybe just clarify exactly where in Mozambique you are and around Beira, and then explain a little bit where Bagaja is in relation to that.
After the cyclone hit, the airport in Beira had become a like central sort of distribution hub. An information hub. It became a central place for the military, helicopters, aid organizations, that sort of stuff. So we had organized to climb on a helicopter with one of the South African aid organizations, where we flew to a distribution hub. And we touched down there, and quickly we realized that, that there was a community down the road that had been completely wiped away. They were only really experiencing their first few days being able to move around after being sort of landlocked by this huge body of water that moved through. I mean, this is like any journalist will know that this is where the story is. So we moved in there. We were able to tell those stories. So we flew from the Beira airport, roughly 70 kilometers upstream from the upstream along the Buzi River. It's about 70 kilometers as the crow flies from Beira Airport, and it is just sort of it's kind of south down the Buzi River. And that's more or less where Bagaja is.
Yeah, and I think just being there last year to see such an impact and such a large loss of life and kind of just witness just so much being taken away in an instant and seeing afterwards how the world's eyes kind of shift from one thing to the next. I remember leaving Beira, and I think the headlines that week after that was there was some attack in Syria, and everyone kind of forgot about all these lives that were affected and all these people that had lost everything, really. And then I wasn't with Alistair and with Jeff when they went last year. And visiting the communities was more important than actually staying out towards where there's more built up areas, because these were the communities that were affected. They're unmapped. They're unknown to the world. People don't know that they exist, and they kind of, yeah, we wanted to focus on seeing how these communities have been reborn after the cyclone, and how life kind of carries on.
So I want to bring it down to the individual level. I'm going to ask you guys a little bit about the sort of individuals in the area that you met. One aspect of your story that I found was really interesting wasn't just going back and taking an overview of the area. You're going back and speaking to some of the same individuals that you had done a story on the year before. What was interesting to me as well was just the way, one, that the whole village was wiped out of Bagaja, and then they effectively moved the village or resettled in another area. One question I still have around that is, what is the consistency to the village in that sense? Is it largely the same people that relocated in the same place, or did everyone get scattered and they just decided, well, there were some settlements in this new location, so they kind of rebuilt from there? I mean, what was the story behind that?
So I think also to just put into context Bagaja as a village, traveling to Bagaja, you get the closest village on a map is Estequina, 10 kilometers down the road. You'll find Bagaja village. Now, Bagaja used to be closer to the Buzi River. The Buzi River is somewhat of a lifeline for the people. So where Bagaja was situated prior to the cyclone and the subsequent flooding, that was completely wiped away. That was completely gone. And then that village, the same people, apart from those that were lost and perhaps a couple have moved a little bit further, we did hear of some that no longer live there. For the most part, they've just resettled into a new location. The same people still relying on the Buzi River as somewhat of a lifeline to fish, to feed themselves, etc. And I'm sure I can elaborate a little bit more.
So when we spoke to the chief about population statistics, he said that there are before the actual flood, there were 1,691 residents of Bagaja. After the flood, there were 1,634, which is quite a substantial difference. That's quite a large body of people are moving, and I mean that could be for a variety of reasons. That could be because people are That could be because people are unsure of the location in relation to the Buzi River and it happening again, having to restart an entire community. But I also think that these populations in these small villages, they do ebb and flow as people move out of those spaces into more urban areas. There's a natural movement of people in these smaller towns. People obviously they move into more built up areas, not necessarily even cities, because Bagaja is very underdeveloped. I would think those statistics are more or less the same. I think the people that grow up in Bagaja very quickly learn a way of life that is that becomes their way of life, and adapting to a more urban environment might be a bit of a culture shock. The language that they're speaking, Bagaja, is not they don't speak Portuguese. Shona.
Ndao,
which is similar to Zulu. Most of the people in Mozambique themselves don't even speak Ndao. It's a language used in a very rural setting. So somebody who only speaks in Dao will struggle in a place in most of the country where they speak Portuguese, for instance. So I think your options of migration are very limited if you are there. But I do think it is natural that populations ebb and flow in these rural settings. So I mean the community there was much less the same, and because it was the same and the population was managed the way it was quite interesting because we were able to work out that 16 people had died. These people had moved. They themselves had a record of who had passed away. They were all very aware of the of the actual toll, the toll on human life that the flood had, because they have such a close-knit community. I mean, the fact that the chief himself, he didn't have to think and pull up a document to show that he had 1,634 residents. He just knew it off by heart because, you know, this is his job in the community to sort of focusing and guide things. So I mean, that gave us an interesting look into the actual the actual physical toll, because they had such a understanding of how the community works, the community itself. They were able to frame the 1 year after very, very well for us.
Can I just add, I think it's quite important just in terms of the chief and the village, how the village is structured. I mean, when Alistair and I arrived, we were first presented to the chief. And then the chief and us and other seniors in the community, all men, were seated around the community. So the community is very aware of itself and very involved with each other. Well, that's the feeling that I got, because so they can really account for who moves and who leaves, because they're very open with each other, and they kind of make sure that everyone's kind of aware of how, like, what's going on around them. Well, that's the feeling that came across for me.
So let's bring it down to the individual level and get sort of stuck into some of the characters that you revisited. Maybe kick off with telling me more about a little bit about Fatima. I thought it was a beautiful video, a beautiful interview. Clearly had quite a devastating story around her family. Just flesh that out for us a little bit.
Alistair and our colleague Jeff had found Fatima last year after the flooding. She'd had to, and Al can correct me if I'm wrong, she'd had to bury her one child directly after the flooding. She couldn't bury her child in the cemetery, correct, Al?
Yeah, there was no, the cemetery was underwater.
So the cemetery was underwater, so she had to make do with what she had. Her other child was lost, never to be seen again. Fatima lost a total of six members of her family passed away in the flooding that succeeded Adai. The pain that she went through, I think it's imaginable, like, it's so difficult to imagine, and you can almost see in her face from Alice's pictures from the year before. Just I thought it was such a gorgeous comparison to how these emotions and how these experiences can really, really, really hurt people. So when we interviewed Fatima this year again, she was a bit unwell, and we sat down outside her house, which is just a plastic tarp over a rudimentary structure. This is what most of Bagaja consists of, as that's what they've been supplied. And as the sun was going down, and I remember thinking to myself, like, geez, what a strong and beautiful woman. Her voice kind of cracked with emotion as she recounted the story, which was then translated to us. And consistently throughout the interview, you almost feel as if there are questions you want to ask to extract the real emotion and the real pain, and so that you can give a real good sense of how the actual person's feeling. And I think I asked her if after the flooding she'd ever felt as if there was no point in living anymore. And out the corner of my eye, I almost saw Alistair kind of turn away, because these are uncomfortable. You're bringing up hurt for people, and I think it's your job to do that. But her facial expressions, and just kind of what she endured, and having to continue as a divorced mother of three now, having lost her other two children, it's something that will live with me forever. I don't think many people understand how much pain and sorrow Fatima had endured.
How is the...
Can I climb in here?
Yeah, sure.
Also, just to bring context, Fatima Bernardo woke up when they started hearing flood water. Because these communities live in, their families live in micro settlements within that settlement, she was able to gather her family, and they essentially sort of realizing that the flood water was coming and that there was nothing actually to climb up on, they were forced with the reality that a lot of Mozambicans in rural areas were faced with. We either climb a tree or we get washed away. So like, just to bring context into this, her entire family gathered around a tree, and this was it's pitch black. There's no there's no street lights, there's no electricity, there's no basic infrastructure. The nearest road was nearby, but by that time it was too late to try and get out of that area. The nearest town is 10 kilometers away. So I mean, imagine having to make this decision, this conscious decision that the place that you live in is now about to be completely washed away, and your only hope for survival is to gather your family and climb up a tree. So I mean, this is what happened in the pitch black. Well, it was early in the morning at this time. I believe that members of the village started waking up at around 12 o'clock, realizing that there's water everywhere, and that you know, there are some accounts that say towards 2:30, 3 o'clock, people were forced into trees. So I mean, if in that timeline that story that is the most frightening thing. To think that you saw that you saw your parents grow up in this space, and you've always had the sense of security. You didn't think that this is what it would come to. So anyway, now you're forced with this dilemma. Okay, now we're all standing. The water is at our ankles. What do we do? We climb a tree. And what happened with Fatima is that she climbed the tree with some of her family members and watched as one by one they fell into the water. They lost their grip. They fell into the water. And essentially having to watch your family members being taken away by a body of water that doesn't exist. You've been awake for all of 3, maybe 4 hours. And, you know, among those 6 family members, your daughter and your son, who are toddlers, they're not of age. They're it's difficult for them to hold onto a tree physically. Because they don't have the strength or the, you know, and it's an incredible thing to imagine, and it's incredibly scary and devastating and like completely and utterly mind shattering to think of the actual trauma that thousands of people had to endure. I mean, So, when we were telling these stories of Fatima, it constantly rang out that as we interviewed people throughout the village, their stories all had a similar narrative. The floodwaters came. We didn't know where to go. It was extremely confusing and disorientating. There was a loud sound. People were screaming. We were forced to climb up trees. That narrative was the same. And as we speak to people and get more personal, it starts to ring home that their story is similar to thousands of other Mozambicans in the area. And because we were some of the first respondents there and the first people to tell those stories, you think, like, is the story being properly told? Are these people being represented? Do we completely understand the actual psychological effects of a natural disaster in that setting? It became increasingly more devastating and difficult to deal with when we realize when you start to put these personal stories into a larger context.
That leads on to my next question beautifully, in the sense that, you know, while the days after the natural disaster happens or other sort of a disaster happens, you know, villagers can almost expect that there's going to be some media coverage, and you know, you've got a story to tell from that side. But it's quite a rare occasion. At least it's increasingly more rare in our profession, whereby we actually do go back a year later when there isn't a strong news hook and actually revisit some of the individuals that were affected a year earlier. So my question would be, like, how did the village respond to you coming back? Were you welcomed? What was the energy in the village? Were people keen to tell their stories, or were they not? Or, you know, what was the general energy?
I think as to kind of lead into that. So as we got to Bagaja, you travel through like kind of the bush. It's so remote. There's no proper roads. There's a dirt road. You have to have a vehicle that can handle this kind of traveling. Everyone else around the area, the only other vehicle you'll see is motorbikes. So as soon as this big car kind of arrives, you get the looks, you get the kind of excitement, the kind of curiosity you could expect from people that aren't accustomed to seeing this kind of vehicle. I mean, I think Alistair said last year, Joachim, our fixer and a local English teacher, he'd actually said to Alistair that the people they met last year had never seen white people before. They hadn't seen foreign people before. It was completely new to them. So going back, this is a community that they're not accustomed to outsiders, but they welcomed us with open arms. We lived with them for 3 days. We camped out in the village. It's very rural. There's no electricity. There's one water pump. But it will never leave my mind how we entered the village and we got introduced to the chief, and they rang a bell, and the bell kind of echoed across this beautiful village with subsistence farming going around, women sweeping with outside their homes. And the bell rang out, and people started to gather under this beautiful baobab tree, and we sat there and we were introduced to the villagers. And the kind of scene you can expect to see in that situation, would see in that situation, is tens of villagers, dozens of villagers, kind of sitting in front of you, and there's mothers, they're breastfeeding their children, everyone's just kind of curious to see what's going on. And we engaged with the community, and we told them we're here to tell their stories, and we asked them if we could integrate ourselves among them. They shouldn't give us too much mind, which is a bit difficult because with the cameras and a drone, everyone's eyes are kind of always drawn towards you. And they asked us questions, and through our translator, we conversed with the community beforehand, and throughout our time there, people were happy to share their pain, their suffering, what life is like now. Life for them isn't perfect as it stands. There's food security issues. There's the housing is still just this rudimentary white tops over the structures that were built last year. So they were extremely happy to see that some kind of level of international care was being given to them.
You had a particular interest in the gravesites, and when you first pitched the gravesites to me, you wanted an interactive map of sorts. And you know, we had a bit of back and forth around it and whether it was going to add some value to the story. But in retrospect, I'm glad we did go ahead with it, because while the information around those gravesites wasn't a lot, it almost makes sense that it wasn't a lot. I think it represents the bigger story of, like, you know, people just had to bury their loved ones where they could. You know, when you're out there in the rural area, you know, those kind of luxuries just aren't really available to you. I thought maybe you can flesh out that angle of the story a little more in terms of, you know, photographing the grave sites, those small mementos and things that are there, and also maybe who showed you around, who showed you those sites.
The whole inception of the idea came when we started thinking about how to look at the story that happened between the space that we were there and visiting 1 year after. And when you do think about that situation, there's a few scenarios that you can make sure to get. It was one of the other. So that's how the idea came. We were now able to really put a look at one section of rural Mozambique and start to break apart the different elements and tell the story in a narrative that sort of fits in between that space. So one of the things was what happened after the floodwater receded. I think there was a lot of reporting on the flooding, devastation, all of that sort of stuff. But the report stopped coming out in the months that followed. So there was a whole untold story here about how community members, and these are, you know, these are people that have lived peacefully for generations, are now forced to deal with death on such a firsthand matter. You know, that they had to make some very, very difficult decisions because now, you know, people had died and they had to make these decisions. So when we went in there, we actually didn't know it was possible that it could be done. But our fixer, Jaquim, who's the guy who helped us last year, who we managed to track down before we went, told us that he'd be able to actually take us to the places where, places where the community was forced to bury their loved ones. Or fellow community members. They weren't necessarily their family members. They were people that in some places were completely unrecognizable due to the rate of decay in relation to the time of their dying, because, I mean, people spend 3 days in a tree in the hot sun. And I think a lot of these bodies were stuck in treetops. They were washed away because the ground was, I could physically see that the floodwater had been at least 4, 4.5, 5 meters high. If you consider that the floodwater from the Boozy River to where Bay Gaja was, the elevation gain between those two spaces was 10 meters. So it filled up this massive basin of water. Now people were forced to bury the dead. And anyway, so it's very difficult to collect details on people that have passed away that we have no information about, which is another story of people being washed away and being unaccounted for, and the community just having to accept that they've passed away without having a confirmation. They just have to sort of accept this. So in the space of Bay Gaja, in roughly, I think, a 5 to 7 kilometer stretch of road, we were able to find and tag 9 grave sites of 10 people that had passed away. And these were people that were specifically buried by the community because out of necessity, they had to bury the dead. So yeah, in that small 5 to 7 kilometer space, we were able to tag 9 bodies, and I thought a good way to illustrate this would be with a GPS pin on a map, so that it shows specifically this area and the loss of life, but also shows you that this story is similar to other villages, hundreds and affecting thousands of people who essentially drowned in that flood. So the idea here was to get people to get people to see it on a map, and know that we're only focusing on this extremely small space. So it is quite an impersonal way to tell a story. GPS pins on a map with photographs, but because it tells you of the scale of the disaster and the actual physical loss to human life, it really does ring home the personal stories that you've read before. In terms of getting around, it was extremely difficult. We essentially hiked through the dense bush where grass is 2 to 3 meters tall in what was a 36, 37 degree heat, and humidity is extremely high. It is a very difficult place to move around. You're essentially bushwhacking through huge rice fields, and there's no ground in some places. It was quite difficult. Even in that small space, it was difficult to move because there were no footpaths. And in some cases, it took 30 minutes to walk a few kilometers because of the dense bush. So, I mean, these bodies have been buried there, and now they stand as these testaments. And as history sort of goes forward, people aren't visiting the grave sites because they're unknown. But they still sort of serve as this stark reminder of the reality that people had to face once the floodwaters receded a bit. Yeah. And there's burial rites. I mean, like, bodies, for instance, have to be buried facing a certain direction. I can't recall. I didn't notice, but I did have a conversation with our fixer at the time, and he said that one of the bodies had to be buried in a different direction, and is now buried on a very sort of in an unconventional way, they plant a specific plant around the actual grave site itself, as per custom, and they put a plate and a cup down on the actual grave site to represent a family member who's no longer at the dinner table, and also so that when this family member passes into the next realm, that they have a cup and a plate to drink from. And they're all there. I mean, there's a cup and a plate on each of these little grave sites in the middle of nowhere.
I did actually wonder about that. I saw that in your images, and I was like, okay, that's interesting. I was going to ask about that, but okay, cool. That's cleared that up. Look, unfortunately, we're running out of time, guys. But I think as a story as a whole, I mean, I was very happy that we finally got you guys up there and we could send you and you could do a nice retrospective on a year later and catch up on these stories. So yeah, thanks guys. Thanks for joining, Emil and Alistair. I appreciate the work you guys put in. It's great that we finally got it out there. And yeah, thanks for joining on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks guys. Cool man. Thanks for making it happen.